opening for, I think, many of us, and I think many of us can recognize some of the issues in our own states. So switching gears now from going from something that was where the environment directly impacts us to something where the environment is indirectly contributing to potentially some issues that affect our health. I have the great privilege to introduce to you to a great colleague and a friend and a fellow distance runner, Dr. Lyle Peterson. Many of us know him quite well at this point. He has served as the director of the Division of Vector-Borne Diseases since 2004, and he began his training in California, actually, first in the South in UC San Diego, where he received his undergraduate degree in biology, and then he went up north to San Francisco, where he got his medical degree at UCSF, and then at medical school at Stanford. And from there, medical degree at UCSF and Stanford for internal medicine. And then he went and started his long career at CDC, first as an EIS officer, an epidemic intelligence service officer, and continuing on. And many of you may not know, he actually started in HIV/AIDS, where before he switched to where he finally calls home in vector-borne diseases. And he's, as to all of us, he's been our absolute go-to person. He is the most interesting person. He still loves to get down and dirty. I can tell you from personal experience, when he came and visited us in Hawaii to help us evaluate our dengue outbreak, he was out there in the boonies, so to speak, on the Big Island, getting down with the locals and really just trying to get at what's really going on. And to this day, he continues to do that. And in fact, he was telling us he spent yesterday going around Idaho here with some folks to take a look at the mosquito pools, potential mosquito pools here. So he still likes to get down into the trenches, so to speak. And so, Dr. Peterson.
Thank you. And this morning, my title of my talk is The Ongoing Tale of Emerging Vector-Borne Diseases, Past, Present, and Future, and the Need to Build and Sustain a National Vector-Borne Disease Infrastructure. So I'm going to try and convince you in the next 30 minutes of the following things. And if you're convinced, then I'm successful. One is there is an accelerating emergence and incidence of mosquito-borne diseases. Many have or were likely to become endemic throughout the Western Hemisphere, and that includes Zika virus. The second thing is there's an increasing number of tick-borne diseases, which are increasing in incidence and geographic range. And finally, there is a decreasing national, state, and local resilience to respond to all of this, and that we really need to do something now. So this is a timeline of the emergence of arboviruses in the Western Hemisphere. And as you can see from this timeline, in the 1600s, yellow fever and dengue virus were imported via the slave trade in Africa. And along with these two viruses came the vector Aedes aegypti. And most people don't really realize that Aedes aegypti, which we'll talk about a little bit more later, is an introduced species into the Western Hemisphere. So between 1600s and about 1999, not too much happened. My budget remained rather flat during this period of time. And then in 1999 came West Nile virus in New York City, thanks to Marcy Layton and others who helped respond to that, who's sitting here in the second row. So she's still interested in hearing about vector-borne diseases. That's good. And then 14 years later, chikungunya virus came. It was introduced into the island of St. Martin in the Caribbean, spread throughout the Western Hemisphere. And then 2 years later came Zika virus. And actually, Zika virus has been imported actually in two locations. The most one you probably all heard about is in Brazil. But retrospective testing of specimens from Haiti in febrile illness patients showed that actually there was an independent introduction into Haiti, actually slightly before the introduction in Brazil. So what I take from all of this is that there's really an accelerating trend of the emergence of arboviruses in the Western Hemisphere. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about a very simplified version of mosquito-borne diseases. And there's really two varieties for arboviruses. One is on the left side of your screen, is West Nile virus, Japanese encephalitis. And these are viruses that circulate in a natural enzootic cycle, in these cases by birds, in which humans don't develop high enough viremia. And so they really don't contribute to these cycles. So humans are incidental hosts. On the right side of your slide is kind of the big problem right now. And these are viruses, and there's four of them that I've listed. There's a couple more waiting to come. But these viruses circulate between non-human primates and mosquitoes in jungle areas of Africa. But the difference with these is that humans develop a high enough level of viremia to infect mosquitoes. And the Aedes aegypti mosquito is the primary spreader of these kinds of diseases. So when you get this urban epidemic, basically humans are the carriers of this, and so they travel around and can spread the virus rather quickly, but these cause these giant urban epidemics like we saw with Zika virus in the last couple of years. So the extent of this problem, and I'm not going to dwell on Zika virus too much because you're probably tired of Zika virus, but as you can see that within a couple of years, human travel spread these viruses basically throughout much of the world. And since January, we've issued 63 travel notices where pregnant women shouldn't go. And you can also see in this slide that there were small outbreaks in Texas and a little bit larger outbreaks in South Florida, which I'll get to in a second. But one of the things that's striking about this is how fast these diseases spread, because people basically fly around a lot these days. And this is a slide of the cumulative number of countries with Zika by WHO region. And you can see within a few months in 2015 going into 2016, the number of countries affected dramatically increased. I mean, it was really quite remarkable. And most of this increase was due to countries in PAHO region or the Western Hemisphere where the virus spread like wildfire throughout the Western Hemisphere and eventually into the United States. As a result of all of this, we've had a huge number of Zika virus cases imported into the continental United States. We've had more than 5,000 travel-related cases that we've recorded. And if you really think about it, only about 20% of Zika virus cases are symptomatic, and many of those have mild illness and people don't go to the doctor. So the 5,000 travel-related cases really indicates that there were literally tens and tens of thousands of cases of importations of Zika virus in the United States. These resulted in 224 cases of local transmission that were reported to the ARBANET surveillance system, largely in South Florida. There were 50 cases of other routes of transmission, one case of laboratory transmission, 48 cases of sexual transmission, and one case of person-to-person transmission through an unknown route. And if you think about these sexual transmission, and by the way, that Zika virus is the first arbovirus that's been shown to be sexually transmitted in humans. So this was quite unusual. But if you think about it, there's 48 recorded cases, but you only find cases if both partners are symptomatic. And given the fact that one in five people are symptomatic, you can kind of do the math, and you realize that there were probably hundreds or even thousands of sexual transmissions that may have occurred. And these cases of travel imported cases were reported, were basically identified in all of the continental U.S. states. Alaska was spared, and Guam was spared, but the rest of the territories were not. As far as the U.S. territories, it was quite a much more dire situation. We've had 36,000 cases of Zika reported in the U.S. territories. 143 were travel-related, but there were 36,439 local transmission cases. But these were largely in Puerto Rico, but we've done some modeling based on some data from blood donor screening and others, which really suggested that about 25% of the population of Puerto Rico was actually infected. We have no other routes of transmission recorded simply because you can't sort out mosquito transmission from sexual transmission when you've got an ongoing outbreak of this kind of magnitude. One of the things that was very striking to us was the number of pregnant women that we're actually following now who've had any laboratory evidence of possible Zika virus infection. And we've got well over 5,000 women we're currently following. There's about 50 identified, still being identified per week. There's been 1,800 in the United States and the District of Columbia, or the states, and 3,700 from the U.S. territories. This is the epidemic curve in Puerto Rico, and it's suspected cases of chikungunya, dengue, and Zika virus in Puerto Rico. The green represents Zika virus, and you can see that the outbreak peaked in about August and continues to go on at a much lower level to this day. And this pattern, what we've seen in Puerto Rico, pretty much mimics what's been going on in the rest of the countries in the Caribbean and in southern Mexico. Now, you probably are wondering, well, what happened to dengue and chikungunya? Chikungunya is basically sitting at the bottom of the chart. You can't even see it, but it is still being transmitted there. Interestingly enough, dengue, which in a low year in Puerto Rico causes thousands of cases, basically disappeared, and it looks like Zika virus kind of displaced dengue, at least temporarily. Now, going back to before Zika, there was chikungunya, also spread from person to person via the Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, and you can see a very similar pattern in this graph, which shows this chikungunya in the Americas and the number of countries and the number of reported cases. And you can also see that within a matter of a couple of months, the virus spread through almost every country in the Americas. And one of the things that we could do with chikungunya, since most people are symptomatic and have fairly unique symptoms, the reporting is, and the serology and the diagnostic testing is much more clear than with Zika, we can actually get a better estimate of, you know, what was actually going on in terms of numbers of cases. And there were about 1.4 million reported cases, which also probably represents a drop in the bucket. But you can see that, you know, the number of cases also dramatically increased. And so far, we've had about 2.3 million infections with chikungunya virus reported in all the countries there listed, shown on the diagram on the right. But I think the important point here is since we're able to get a better idea of the count of numbers of chikungunya cases, you can see in 2014, there was about 1.1 million, 2015, 730,000, and so forth, 2016, 504,000, so far this year about 86,000. But what this is telling me is if Zika virus and chikungunya virus are behaving in somewhat the same way, which they have so far, that Zika virus is going to continue to cause substantial numbers of cases for the next several years at least. Interestingly enough, the serology in Puerto Rico also suggested that during the first wave of their epidemic, about 25% of the population became infected, which is just about what we estimate for Zika virus as well. Well, while this was going on with Zika virus, we've had yellow fever virus outbreaks in Africa and South America. The largest outbreak in decades occurred in 2015 and 2016 in Angola and the Democratic Republic of Congo, resulting in about 4,300 suspect cases and 884 confirmed cases in Angola and almost 3,000 cases in DRC suspect cases, which resulted in the vaccination of about 30 million people. Subsequently, there was the outbreak in Brazil, Colombia, Ecuador, and Bolivia, which is still going on, which is in Brazil, they had 2,900 suspect cases with a case fatality rate among about 34% among the confirmed. Well, the problem was is that there's a very limited vaccine supply of yellow fever, and basically most of it was burned up in Angola and DRC, which has caused a pretty substantial vaccine shortage, a global shortage of yellow fever vaccine. The other thing that happened was is this was going on at the same time Zika was going on, which really stretched global resources. And finally, dengue, which is the last one I'll talk about, that's spread by the Aedes aegypti mosquito, which I mentioned was there present in the 1600s, was kind of going on at a low level until about 2000. And as you can see from this chart, and this is the number of cases in millions, and that in the last 15 years, the number of cases of dengue have also skyrocketed. The 3 million cases, again, is a drop in the bucket. That's just what's been reported. But as you can see, there's a rapidly increasing trend. Part of this is due to the fact that of these dengue serotypes, there's four dengue viruses, and they're being transported all over the planet by people moving around. And what happens is if you're infected with one dengue virus and subsequently infected with another dengue virus, the illness gets worse on the second time around. And so if you have multiple serotypes of dengue circulating, it's bad news. And this is exactly what's happened in the Western Hemisphere. And on this graph, you can see from yellow to red, the number of serotypes that have been circulating in the region from 1990 to 2014. And basically, we have a hyperendemic situation in much of the Western Hemisphere right now. And so why is all this occurring? And I think there's two things that are really driving all of this. Three things. One is population growth. I mean, what's happened is that as you can see from the top chart, the world's population has increased rather dramatically in recent years, and that's no surprise. There's 6.1 billion people in 2000, over 9 billion expected by 2050. But as you can see in the blue, all of this growth has occurred in third world countries where these diseases are naturally enzootic. The second problem is that the population has become urban. Just a few years ago, more than 50% of the population of the planet was living in urban situations for the first time. And this is largely due to a large increase in urbanization in Asia and Africa, and in fact is the largest human migration in history. So what's happening is you're getting megacities in the tropical world, like the one below, where there's inadequate water supplies, people are storing water, perfect spots for breeding. At the same time, where these diseases are being transmitted within these urban settings, they're being exported everywhere by human movement. And so this is a slide of human movement, actually, of international tourist arrivals. And the thing that's really striking to me is, you know, I'm kind of old, and I was born a while ago. I was born, although within this graph, but but you can see that, you know, by the time I was born, which was back in the Stone Ages, back here towards the left side of this graph, there very few people were moving around. And within my lifetime, the international arrivals have increased 20-fold. I mean, it's really remarkable. It's gone from about 50 million before 1960 to more than a billion now of international arrivals. So it's not so difficult to see why these diseases are spreading around, particularly those that are spread by humans. So switching back gears towards West Nile, this is a graph of West Nile virus incidence by year, and West Nile's different because birds are the primary reservoir. Birds have a pretty high turnover, so you can have outbreaks every single year, practically, because there's not a long-standing immunity in birds. And so you can see that that West Nile incidence kind of went down for a while about 2011, and the OMB examiner eliminated my entire budget in 2011, saying that West Nile had gone away. Congress reversed that, and I think she was pretty happy about that in 2012 when we had this big outbreak, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But West Nile remains a big problem. We've had about more than 20,000 reported cases of neuroinvasive disease with about a 10% mortality rate. But for every reported neuroinvasive disease cases, there's roughly 30 to 70 non-neuroinvasive disease cases. So this disease has so far caused probably well over a million cases of non-neuroinvasive West Nile virus disease. And I can tell you from personal experience, I used to say it was a mild disease to get West Nile fever, but after I got it, it became a very serious problem. But it's also for every neuroinvasive disease case, there's roughly 150 to 300 infections, so millions of people have been infected so far, which presents a problem for the blood supply. This is the annual incidence on a population basis of West Nile virus disease over the last 16 years. And the thing that's really remarkable to me about it is it tells the story of what happens when these exotic tropical arboviruses get imported into a new area like the United States. I mean, who would have guessed that the Dakotas would have been the hotbed of West Nile virus? You can also see where you're sitting right now. It's in a black zone, so wear your repellent. And there's also places like Phoenix, you know, which are also hotbeds of, in the middle of the desert, of a tropical mosquito-borne disease. And it's largely because of irrigation. And this is really almost a map of irrigation, because many of the mosquitoes that spread West Nile, like Culex tarsalis, breed in irrigated farmland. The natural cycle of West Nile is very complicated, and I won't go into this, but it just shows that how difficult, there's many, many factors, environmental factors, influencing the transmission of West Nile virus, which vary from place to place throughout the United States. So it's been very difficult to actually model or predict these kinds of diseases just because it's so complicated. But the one thing that all these models of West Nile virus have done has shown that they're pretty consistent in that increasing temperature, increasing like heat waves, augment these outbreaks. And almost every model has shown this. And the reason for that is several-fold, but one of them is it shortens the time from infection to infectiousness in the mosquito, which is called the extrinsic incubation period. And it also increases viral replication in mosquitoes, making them more infectious. And so what has happened is this is actually a logarithmic function. So the hotter the temperature, the shorter this time to a mosquito becoming infectious is, there's a logarithmic effect on transmission. So these outbreaks tend to occur during heat wave, which obviously has an important issue when you talk about climate change, you know, and what potential climate change could potentially have. And in fact, in New York City, when the virus was first identified in 1999, it was during a record heat wave in the city. So I'm going to just talk briefly about tick-borne diseases. And mosquitoes get all the attention because they cause big outbreaks, but ticks are still there, and we all hate them too. And so this is the discovery of tick-borne pathogens as a cause of human disease within the last 50 years. And you can see from this chart that the number of tick-borne diseases that have been identified is accelerating, and we're basically finding a new one every year. It's partially because we have better ability to find them, but it's also probably due to the fact that more of these are being transmitted. This is the chart of Lyme disease. Lyme disease is going up, and it's steadily going up. Lyme disease reporting, for those of you who are in the Lyme disease states, know that it's considerably underreported. And our estimates right now is that we have about 300,000 cases of Lyme disease every year. And it's also spreading. And as you can see from this chart, this is a dot map of Lyme disease cases from 2001 and 2015. And I mean, this is really remarkable if you think about it. And people say, well, maybe it's climate change and the Lyme disease is going north. Well, it is, but it's also going south. It's also going east, and it's also going west. It's just becoming a massive problem. The other nationally notifiable tick-borne diseases like Rocky Mountain spotted fever, ehrlichiosis, and anaplasmosis are also going up due to a variety of environmental changes also. And one of the things that's probably been most studied is the emergence of Lyme disease and why that is occurring. And on the left side of your chart, you can see a picture of New England in the 19th century, and you can see that it was pretty much deforested. And at that time, deer were pretty much wiped out, and Ixodes scapularis, the vector, is a deer tick. And so what's happened is in the middle picture, you can see that these areas have been reforested and people have moved in, and they're sitting in the middle of the forest. And what's also happened is that deer stopped being hunted. And so you can see in the chart in the middle that the number of deer is skyrocketing. So with the skyrocketing number of deer, you get skyrocketing numbers of ticks, and then you get skyrocketing numbers of Lyme disease. So you've got a situation with tons of deer, literally, in everyone's backyard with ticks all over the place and people living in the middle of the habitat. So I think there's two major challenges of dealing with all this. First, we live in a data-free zone. There's really no proven control measure for Aedes aegypti mosquito, which I've pointed out spreads dengue, yellow fever, chikungunya, and Zika virus. We have no known way of controlling this in a way that's scalable and doable at the present time. We also have no known proven control measure for Ixodes scapularis ticks, which spread Lyme disease, Powassan virus, anaplasmosis, babesiosis, and Borrelia, the all-purpose tick for disease. And we really don't know how to control it on a way that's scalable and transferable from place to place. And insecticide resistance is also a big problem for mosquito control. It's one of the problems we had in Miami of controlling Zika virus was that all the insecticides we used the mosquitoes were resistant to them, forcing us to do aerial spraying. There's also a diminished capacity in the U.S. to deal with all of this. We've had eroding technical capacity at all levels. There's a shrinking entomological workforce, which became very apparent during the Zika outbreak. We had real trouble recruiting qualified medical entomologists to really jump in here and help deal with this problem. The surveillance infrastructure is also diminishing, and we're also dealing with a patchwork of vector control units across the United States. They're largely underprepared, and they focused historically on Culex mosquitoes, but now have to focus also on Aedes aegypti. And also we have inadequate diagnostics. So one of the, so I'll just illustrate a couple of points here. One is there was a recent survey done by the National Association of county and health, city health officials, which surveyed vector control units in the southern United States and showed that about 68% of them need improvement. They're lacking at least one of five basic capacities that we think they should have. And this was a survey done a couple of years ago, done by CSTE, showing that that the an erosion of the ability of local health departments and state to collect, do mosquito-based surveillance. And the impact of this is, I think, illustrated on this chart, and this is my last slide, and I'll walk you through this. This is what happened in Dallas. And so this is a timeline from June to October, with a number of cases on the left axis, and on the right is something called the vector index, which is basically the number of infected mosquitoes out there, roughly. And so if you look at the green line, it's the vector index, and you could see that it was starting to go up pretty dramatically in early June. The yellow is the actual onset of disease cases, and so which also went up with the vector index, but obviously you don't know what that is in real time. And red, it was the actual timing of the number of reported cases. And so you could see that there's almost a month delay between the time when the vector index went up and the cases started occurring and the reporting. And you can see there when aerial spraying was actually done, the number of reported cases was actually starting to go down. But you can also see that if you look at the yellow line, the disease onset, that by the time something effective was done, 90% of the cases had already occurred. It did stop the rest of the outbreak, but it was way too late. And I think this is what's happening year after year after year with West Nile virus, just not in Dallas, but most places else. And this is why we're continuing to have these outbreaks every year, is this basic erosion in capacity. So what we're proposing is a coordinated strategy to deal with this. One is to advance innovation and discovery. The other is to build comprehensive vector control or vector programs, which include vector control units, but with state and local health departments sort of at the helm of this, to rebuild this workforce to deal with vector-borne diseases, and also to build robust state and local vector control programs. And there's three lanes of this, and I won't go through this in detail, but one is to increase laboratory capacity in health departments. The second is to improve case and outbreak investigation. And the third is to improve vector control and to have a more effective linkage between health departments and vector control units and having them work in concert. So with that, I'll end, and I think we're going to take questions after this. So thank you very much.
So if folks would go up to the microphone, then please introduce yourself before you ask your question. We have some time.
Mike Allen from Lansing, Michigan. I have a question about the water quality.
Yes.
I'm from Michigan, so I understand water disparity. We won't go there mm-hmm. today. But I'm confused on the economics of it, because what you were showing were maps where there were small enclaves already surrounded by municipal water lines. It costs a lot to run a big line out, say, 2 miles to a new subdivision. That's the big cost. But once it's laid, in the state of Michigan, if you're within a certain distance of a water line, you have to hook up, because the economics say we want everybody to hook up who's close enough to do so. So I'm looking at those maps, and I'm going, why isn't the municipal water system itself saying we want those neighborhoods hooked up? Because, you know, when you do the analysis of the 20-year cost of it, that's paying back the cost. And I'm just wondering why they didn't have the power to say, we want, if we're going to surround this neighborhood, we want the neighborhood hooked up.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I don't think North Carolina has an equivalent law, so there is no mandatory hookup, at least, yeah, I'm not sure about that. I do know one cost issue is who's going to pay the cost to run the connection to the household? And
well, in Michigan, the household has to.
Yes, and that's the way. And that's
it's dispersed over several years, so the municipality doesn't pay that.
Yeah. So in North Carolina, I am not sure what the funding mechanisms are for households, but it's very expensive, as you know, to run
right.
a connection. And also, in the major utility in Wake County has a $2,500 one-time fee to connect to the municipal utility.
Absolutely.
That's not, it's just, it's right. a fee, and that doesn't cover the plumbing cost or
right.
anything.
Right, but that's money coming into
right.
municipal water.
Right, so why don't they do it? I don't
so
know.
Why, you know, I'm just economically, if I was sitting on the municipal water board, I'd be going, I don't want my pipe sitting next to a house that's not connected.
Yeah.
That's where my money is.
Right.
Okay.
Good question. And I don't know what the thinking is. I'd like to talk more with you and find out what's more, you know, more about what goes on in Michigan that might be different from North Carolina state policy.
Hi, Kathy Lannan-Kugel from Iowa. I had a question regarding the lead testing of the water and the underbed
yes.
issues. Did you do any analysis looking at whether or not it was the source water discrepancy
great
or whether
question.
Or not it was the piping and the lead reservoirs in the home that were probably
so
lead?
I took that slide out, but the lead is highly correlated with indicators of you know, corrosion of plumbing. But what we also have seen in North Carolina is that the lead component or the well components themselves can also corrode. So sometimes the lead arises within the well and is transported to the home. In other cases, you know, the water coming out of the well is clean, but then the plumbing corrodes. A big problem, again, is, you know, what we also found is that hardly anybody tests their water ever, so they're not aware. And if you've got an aggressive groundwater and people unaware of the corrosion risks, right, there's just, you know, it's going to continue to corrode plumbing. So, yeah.
I'm Karina Blackmore with the Florida Department of Health, and I also have a water question. So when we have contaminants, we work with our Environmental Protection Agency to offer hookup to municipal water or filters. And quite often there is resistance because of the cost that is incurred to the homeowner, both the potential. I think in our state we waive some of the hookup costs, but then you have a monthly cost that you don't then have when you have well water. And I wonder, when you worked with your communities, whether you, with those water sampling surveys and so forth, whether you discussed with them about their level of interest of actually becoming connected to the municipal water sources.
So, yeah, the community's interest in becoming connected, that's a great question, and we actually have a survey out to 1,000 households right now. Some people would prefer to be connected to the municipal system. Others are concerned about the cost. They view their well water as free. You know, they're not aware that they need to expend money taking care of their well, obviously. So cost is a big issue for the community members as well. And, you know, that's another kind of policy issue, I think. Is there a model where these communities could receive some kind of economic support for paying the cost of connections and also paying their water bills?
Hi. I am part of the Environmental Public Health Tracking Program at the state grantee level in Kentucky. And one of the projects coming down the pipe with the tracking program is mapping of public community water service boundaries. And I was curious what you might advise on how to deal with the security concerns that arise from acquiring and providing that kind of information.
Good question. I will tell you, we also looked in North Carolina. We do have maps of community water service boundaries, but we found that a lot of the community water systems will just report that they serve the entire county. So for us, that wasn't useful for actually pinpointing the neighborhoods that are served. And even where communities have more community systems have more granular maps, as you could see from some of the maps I showed, the locations of these excluded areas are really small, so they tend to be overlooked in those maps. I don't know the logistics of dealing with the security concerns. I assume if you're a state agency that you might be able to get around some of that. Yeah, but that's a really good question. We did have an organization in North Carolina in 1997 put together a map of all municipal utility pipes for the 75 rural counties of the state, but that hasn't been updated since 97. But if you wanted, I could connect you with the organization that put together that map. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Amanda Brzezowski from the St. Louis County Department of Public Health. My question is for Dr. Peterson. We have an absolutely wonderful vector control program that is housed within our county public health department, but like most, their resources are almost entirely directed towards mosquitoes, but the burden of disease is largely tick-borne. So I was wondering if you had any suggestions in how to increase the capacity either politically to try to get the awareness there or literally in terms of increasing the capacity for surveillance or control of tick-borne diseases.
Yeah, I think the problem with mosquito-borne, I mean, the advantage of mosquito-borne diseases is we have tools that we know can reduce the numbers of them. The problem with tick-borne diseases is that the tick-borne diseases, especially in the Midwest, they're kind of spread out. And we really don't know how to control them. It's one of the big problems. So I think with tick-borne diseases, we're a little bit more downstream or upstream in the sense that we really need to try and figure out what is the most effective way of controlling or dealing with these problems before trying to develop large-scale prevention programs like you've got with the mosquito control districts. So I think we're just kind of at a different stage of where we are with our knowledge base with the two. So it is an intractable big problem and hard to deal with.
Hi, my name is Jessica Eckhart, and I have a water question. I'm a sociologist, so it's going to be power focused. You mentioned power, which I really appreciate, and it seems like a lot of the reason why a lot of these communities are in this situation is because of racial dominance and power. And so I was wondering, in your qualitative interviews, either among people in the enclave or decision makers, if they were aware of those racial power differentials and if there was a call to action to end some of that power differential.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So my student, Julia, you could see from her, she spoke to six community members, and I don't know the specifics on power dynamics in those communities, but there are the Mebane community that I showed you maps of. There's an organization there called the West End Revitalization Association that's been extremely active and, has worked to, empower themselves. A lot of the communities, though, are afraid to step forward, and the reason is that they're afraid if a health director someone from the health department comes onto their property and finds a failing septic system, the perception is that their land could be condemned if they can't afford to repair or replace their septic systems. And what you would have seen from the quotes I put on there is a lot of cases, the property doesn't even really have adequate capacity anymore for a modern septic system. So there's a lot of fear. So there really aren't many communities that have mobilized. None of the ones I worked with in Wake County have mobilized. They're just under the radar.
Thanks. Mm-hmm.
We have time for maybe two more questions.
Hi, this is David Atterman from the state of Florida. And I had a question for you, Dr. Peterson, on your view on, on genetically modified organisms and mosquitoes, including gene drives and CRISPR technology to target Aedes aegypti and the relevant ticks.
So I think let's just start with the oxytech mosquitoes. It's a sterile insect technique where you release large amounts of male mosquitoes and essentially drive when they mate with wild type females, they produce sterile offspring or offspring that don't develop. And I think it's a good technology, but there are several problems with it. One is no one will ever give you a cost estimate because you really have to keep releasing these mosquitoes in very high numbers. So its scalability, I think, is yet to be determined. I think the bigger problem is this public acceptance. As you probably know from in Florida, you know, they've been trying to get them to release them. They had a public referendum. The referendum said, oh, fine, you can release them, but not on our island. You know, so it's not my backyard. And I think that's the biggest hurdle, is actually overcoming, you know, the public acceptance part of it. But I think it's a good technology that ought to be tried someplace. It's been tried in other countries and drove down the populations of Aedes aegypti, whether, but they haven't proven that it's reduced human disease yet, which needs to be proven. They just haven't done it. As far as gene drives and all that, I think you're even talking about another order of magnitude in terms of public acceptance, you know, of trying to get it actually done. And obviously, if you're dealing with the Oxitec mosquitoes, there's no genetically modified mosquitoes remaining in the environment. Gene drive, you're really talking about something that will essentially wipe out the population. And so I think there's a lot of concern about that. But it's also something that theoretically should work quite well.
One more question.
Karina, back
well,
in Florida,
Department
of Health. Oh, go ahead, Michael.
Okay. I'm sorry. I don't have a question. I have a comment.
Okay.
I am so frustrated by this water presentation, and listening to the questions that have come up is like it's a surprise to people. This is an issue that's been here since we put in these infrastructure systems and lots of infrastructure. And when are we going to stand up and say that we start to invest in collecting data on water in this country and waterborne disease in this country? It's still here. And so my frustration is we continue, because we don't have large amounts of funding, not to do anything. But we know that we can do better, and we can invest in this, we can collect more data, and we can make a difference here when people across the country are paying for this. There are 45 million about people not on municipal water systems. We know their water is not good. So let's ask our states, demand our states, and demand from federal, sorry, it's Michael Beach CDC, demand from federal, let's do something and quit just talking about it instead of actually fixing these issues. It's just frustrating, sorry.
Okay, Karina, last question.
All right, this is a question for Dr. Peterson. Also, you mentioned the population growth and so forth and we didn't really talk about the Aedes aegypti eradication project in South America in the 60s, and I at least personally, and please let me know if you disagree, believe that somehow or left the Western Hemisphere, the disease rates in the Western Hemisphere lower for some period of time until the recent years. And I'm wondering, you know, when we do find the magic bullet or the magic bullets to control Aedes aegypti beyond the DDT that was used in the 60s, do you think that there's a possibility politically today to do having a similar focus on Central and South America and eradicating aegypti?
Yeah, I think it depends what it is that we find to eliminate it or eradicate it. And what Karina was referring to was back in starting in the 1940s or 1950s, I'm not sure exactly what decade, there was a guy named Fred Soper who led this army of people across Latin America that basically did a source reduction campaign. They eliminated every breeding site they could find, and if you weren't home, they'd break down your door and throw kerosene in your toilet. I don't think that would be very acceptable today. And then with DDT, which proved exceedingly effective, that combination basically almost wiped out Aedes aegypti from the Western Hemisphere. It was really successful. And it was so successful that the Pan American Health Organization said, well, we've solved the problem, and they stopped this whole campaign. The question is at this point in time, can you actually do something like that? And I think the answer is no. First of all, people don't like their door being broken down. But the second thing is in these mega cities that have arisen in the tropical world, there's just no way that you can eliminate all the breeding sites in those locations. And people have tried. It hasn't been successful. So we clearly need a different way of dealing with these diseases, and it's not quite clear what that way is right now.
I believe we're a couple minutes past time, so please join me once again in thanking both of our wonderful speakers.